Podcast for Thursday, February 12th. My guest this morning, Pat Borzi, is a freelance writer from Minneapolis whose work has appeared in such prestigious publications as the New York Times, USA Today, and Minnesota Post. His latest piece in this past Sunday's New York Times focused on the fast-growing sport of pond hockey. Pat, welcome to the View My Seats podcast, and thanks for joining me this morning.
Hi, John. Thanks for inviting me on.
So as a sports journalist, what drew you to Lake Nokomis and the United States Pond Hockey Championships this past January?
Well, to begin with, it's only about 2 miles from my house here in Minneapolis, and it's a tournament that's gone on for 10 years now. And the thing that fascinated me about it was it billed itself as the U.S. Championships. But if you look around, and I did some homework on it, there's also a U.S. Championships in Wisconsin. There's a North American Championships that's on another lake here in the greater Twin Cities area that was a week after that tournament on Lake Nokomis. There's another tournament in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan that's about the same size as these other ones that does not build itself as a U.S. championship, but probably could since it's sanctioned by USA Hockey and sponsored by the same beer company that sponsors the other ones. The thing that fascinated me is that this thing is that there's really no declared champion. And I thought, well, you know, why isn't this? And then as I went into the reporting and talked to some of these people, I discovered they don't want one. Interested in seeing who the best one is. And I thought that was pretty refreshing. I mean, generally you get into any kind of situation that's run by adults and you want to determine one true champion. And these guys don't care. They just do it for the fun of it. And, you know, the camaraderie and, you know, there's no prize money. Some of these, the one in on Lake Nokomis here in Minneapolis, they have what's called a golden shovel. They have this one big snow shovel and they put little nameplates on it when you win your division. And that's the only trophy in the whole place. And these guys just do it because they just love to play hockey. And I thought that was kind of cool. So it made for a lot of fun.
Right. And this adds to my outsider's perspective of the festivities, which is that these pond hockey tournaments, on the surface at least, seem like a perfect excuse to spend a weekend drinking beer with your buddies.
Bingo.
But beyond the booze, what attracts such an interesting and diverse group of people to these tournaments?
Well, there are a couple of things. To begin with, a lot of these guys grew up playing hockey on ponds and lakes and rivers or in backyard rinks here in the Midwest. There's a lot of that. I mean, I haven't lived in New York for a while now, so I don't remember seeing very much of it when I lived there, but I can tell you that as you in a lot of the parks here in the Twin Cities, the Parks Department builds rinks. You know, they build actual boards and then they flood them and people play. Probably three blocks from Lake Nokomis, there's a nice neighborhood where a guy has built his own rink in between his house and the neighbor's house, complete with lights. And I've run into many people who have played on such homemade rinks or on ponds as kids. And what this does is it reminds all these guys who are now in adulthood, they're in their 20s, their 30s, their 40s, some of whom played college hockey, some didn't, handful of guys played in the pros, and it just reminds them being kids of just going out and playing freely and just messing around with your buddies. And that's become the really big attraction. I mean, if you look at the numbers that USA Hockey puts together, they don't specifically track how many people play pond hockey, but adult participation has really jumped over the last decade. And I think some of it is all the kids that started playing hockey in the aftermath of the USA beating the Russians in 1980 at the Olympics. All those guys are adults now. And a lot of them are even the ones that are a generation past that. I mean, they all remember playing as kids, and it's just a reminder of just the way you played as a kid, which I find that with pretty much everybody that I talk to out there at this tournament.
And it is incredibly refreshing that that's the case. And you mentioned the numbers, and from your article in this past Sunday's New York Times, the numbers are truly astounding. This past year, USA Hockey, which you've said doesn't track these numbers specifically, but they estimated that about 167,000 people participated in some sort of pond hockey tournament last year, and that's up from 75,000 in 2004 and 2005. So clearly this is business is good, business is booming. And to add to why so many people play pond hockey, I have a good group of buddies from college who every February gather together for a pond hockey tournament in Meredith, New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
And they say that one of their favorite aspects of the experience is the imperfection. You know, the temperature varies, there are ruts in the ice, snow builds up on the surface. So, you know, in short, the conditions have a way of leveling the playing field. In your reporting, did you find that much of the growing appeal of pond hockey was due to its relative accessibility to all different types of skill levels?
Yeah, they have in a lot of these tournaments. And before I answer that, I ought to correct one thing. The numbers that you were quoting,
yes,
for just adult participation, they don't specify pond. No, that's okay. Just don't necessarily – they don't break it down into pond hockey compared to, who plays at actual refrigerated indoor rinks. But accessibility is an excellent point. I mean, in a lot of these, I mean, in Minnesota, they have, I think it's 7 or 8, and I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but it's 7 or 8 different divisions. In Wisconsin, I believe it's 19. They're broken up by age, by skill level, by gender. And pretty much if you've got any kind of, if you've played any hockey at all, there's a division for you in one of these tournaments. And it's okay. You know, you don't have to be a former NHL player or a former Division I player or a former Division III player to participate in one of these. You know, it's kind of like, running a road race or running a marathon. I mean, you can be of any kind of level and still participate and still get some enjoyment out of it. And I think that, and you're right, that is a big part of the attraction.
And I think another thing to add to the idea of the imperfection and the accessibility is that there's a certain degree of sweat equity that goes into participating in a pond hockey tournament. You know, you are there as a participant, but you are also there to help prepare the tournament for play. And I think that brings a lot of people back to, as you said earlier, their childhood when, you know, you'd have a pond in your backyard or your buddy would have a pond in their backyard and you'd go back, but before you could go back and play a game, you'd have to clear the surface and then you'd have to smooth the surface out. And, you know, sports today are kind of ready-made to just step on and play. And I think a lot of us feel the need to kind of go back to our roots when things were much more, there was a little bit more effort that went into these games than just simply having these games presented for you.
Right. I mean, I can, you know, I played baseball as a kid, and I'm old enough to remember the time when you didn't have actual, where you were like using different things for bases. You were using rocks. You would, you know, find a piece of cardboard or something and put a rock on it, and that was a base. And you did makeshift stuff just so you could go and play because you didn't have all the exact equipment. And pond hockey is very much the same way. You know, I didn't know any of this because I didn't play any. I played a little street hockey with my brother in the driveway as a kid on Long Island.
Yeah.
But we didn't have any. We didn't skate on lakes. We didn't do any of this. But I've learned all this now from being around people here that in these pond hockey tournaments, what they do is that you have two guys, generally, you know, guy on each team. They take a shovel and they scrape the ice. So they scrape all the loose impediments and junk off the ice before you play and then after you play. They don't have Zambonis. Actually, the Minnesota tournament did have a Zamboni.
Is that right?
Yeah. It was really funny because the day that had the final, it was like 32 degrees.
Yeah.
And the ice was still plenty thick enough because it had been very cold for the 2 weeks before. But I'm thinking, you know, I don't know whether this is a good idea having
right.
it out on the ice. But it was fine and nothing happened. But then they had that for, I don't know whether, they had apps pretty much for show, but for the most part, they had all these like 20-something rinks going and you would just scrape it off with a shovel. And in the Wisconsin tournament, the Minnesota tournament had these like kind of polyurethane boards that they used. They're real small, probably about 18 inches high, and maybe polyurethane's the wrong word, some sort of hard plastic, you know what I mean?
Yes, yes.
But in Wisconsin, what they do is that they plow little hills of snow up next to the rink. So, and I mentioned this in the story.
You did, yes, yeah, I like this.
That, you know, you lose pucks in these little things of snow, and that when the snow melts before the ice completely melts in the spring, the fire department in Eagle River goes in there and they retrieve 700 or 800 pucks out of these little snow banks.
Yeah.
They give them all to the local hockey associations and they can use the next season.
No, that is truly funny. And that to me is so much part of the fun of pond hockey. The appeal of pond hockey is that you don't even need to be a hockey player per se to enjoy the activity, to enjoy the camaraderie. And you just got me thinking now about something, about the spontaneity of pond hockey and sports in general. Is, you know, I have two young children, and part of my concern with them moving forward is if they do turn to sport, that so much of the sport that we present them is going to be kind of scheduled for them.
Right.
That so much of what appealed to us when we were younger with athletics was that it was spontaneous. You know, you get off the bus after school and you throw your coats down on either end of the lawn and you play, you know, two-hand touch football. Nowadays, you know, as parents, we are pushed to making sure that our kids are signed up for their soccer leagues, to make sure that our kids have their time accounted for. And it worries me as a parent that, you know, there won't be the same joy that my children will find with sport that I did as a kid, because we have a tendency to overschedule our kids. And the beauty of pond hockey in these tournaments and why people continue to play in these great numbers is because it brings them back to a time when they just did it for fun and things weren't scheduled for them.
Yeah, and that, I think that's a big part of the attraction too. The Minneapolis Star Tribune just did a story about basketball traveling teams. Okay, there's a community here that has three traveling teams for fourth graders for basketball. And you read some of the comments from the parents and this, and you just kind of shake your head and you go, fourth grade? I mean, maybe you were a much better athlete in fourth grade than I was, John, but I'm not even sure I could have even gotten a basketball on the rim.
Right.
You know, in fourth grade.
Which is okay.
Yeah. And I'm thinking traveling teams, but you're right. I think I know a lot of parents and a lot of families, and I'm not trying to disparage anybody here, but I know a lot of them that spend a lot of their Saturdays and most of their Sundays trucking their kids to all these different scheduled places and, you know, for sports and whatever. And it's gotten to the point that in some communities that if your kid does not participate on one of these traveling teams before they get to high school, and I know this is particularly the case in some places in soccer, they've got no chance of playing for the high school, junior varsity or varsity.
Right.
And these things can be expensive. They can be very time consuming. And it's really, really troubling because it really, you know, I'm stumbling with my words here, and I apologize for that because I've got a lot of things going through my head, but there's so little free play. You know what I mean?
And
the spontaneity that you talk about and being able to just play with your friends and just to, you know, kind of use your imagination and come up with different things. All of this is good. I mean, all this is good when we were all kids.
Right.
And you know, we didn't all turn into a bunch of mass murderers and lunatics.
No, we didn't. And I live in the, I live in the Northeast, and in the Northeast, you know, we have the issue of ice time is at a premium.
Okay.
So in order to, if you're a hockey player in this area, you either have practice very early in the morning sometimes or very late at night, and it costs a lot of money. So therefore, hockey isn't, at least in this part of the country, isn't accessible for everyone, which, again, that's part of the beauty of pond hockey is that it's, you know, for the most part, free. And that is very refreshing in this day and age of everything costing you something.
Yeah. Now, there are more and more kids up in this area that are playing in these established, you know, that are paying to play on these traveling teams and whatever. But because we have so many ponds and lakes in Minnesota, particularly as you get what's called outstate. Well, you know what outstate is. I mean, outside the Twin Cities going north into the Iron Range and south. There are lots of opportunities for kids to play on frozen lakes and ponds and rivers and not have to pay, significant, fees to play in these leagues. And I mean, a lot of kids still play in the leagues because, again, there's a lot of the political stuff that we talked about earlier.
Yes.
But you at least still here have the option of, you know, going out and playing with your friends if you want to. And, you know, having grown up in the Northeast, I grew up on Long Island, and there were very few at a time when there were very, very few rinks and very few places where you could play. You know, I also just did a story for the Times about Val James, who's the first U.S.-born black player in the NHL. He played briefly for the Sabres and Toronto Maple Leafs in the 1980s. And when he grew up in Suffolk County, on the eastern end of Long Island. And basically the only place that you really had to skate in Suffolk County at that time was at the Long Island Arena, which is used by the Long Island Ducks, which were an Eastern Hockey League team.
Right.
If there was another indoor rink available at that end of Long Island, I don't remember it. And again, I grew up a while ago. But there are many more now. You know, my nephew grew up playing hockey. He grew up in leagues, and you know, he ended up playing at Cortland State. But he grew up at a time after the Islanders had gotten there when there had been more and more rinks being built, and there was more opportunity. There's still probably not that many places, I would guess, in the Northeast where kids could go on a frozen pond and play, because there just aren't that many. And, I mean, that's one of the big advantages. I think that's probably why pond hockey is so big in this area. And why there are certain stretches of the Northeast as you go farther into, I mean, you mentioned Meredith, New Hampshire. I know there's at least one other tournament up there. There are a couple of tournaments in upstate New York. I think there's one, it might be one in Vermont somewhere. I don't have the whole list in front of me. But as you go farther away from New York City, particularly as you go deeper into New England, there's a better chance of having ponds and lakes to play on.
I live in Connecticut, and the issue with Connecticut is that it just simply doesn't get cold enough for long stretches of time in order to have pond hockey.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the things I wanted to talk about is there's this kind of my friends have mentioned this to me with pond hockey is that there's this kind of unspoken code of honor that goes into these pond hockey tournaments. Now I know there are officials. But in your reporting, did you find that much of the appeal or the kind of spirit of the sport is that there is this honor code that exists between teams, between teammates, and that you kind of adhere to the rule of law because it's in the spirit of the sport?
Yeah, there's a lot of that. I think it also the guys at the Lake Nokomis tournament were telling me that they gather all the players before the tournament, and the tournament director gives them this speech basically about sportsmanship. And I can't exactly quote them because I heard different versions of this from different people, but the gist of it is that the guy says, "Don't be a jerk." You know, don't get mad and high stick somebody. Don't pull somebody's skates out. Don't act like a clown. Because there are officials. They have two refs because there are no lines, you know,
right.
Blue lines or red lines. So there's no icing or anything or offsides. But they do have one or two guys who stand off ice who will call penalties if you do something egregious. I can tell you that in the early rounds of the Lake Nokomis tournament, it was a lot more sportsmanlike and gentlemanly than it was in the final. When it got a little tipsy, and one guy went into the boards and fell and dislocated his shoulder, and there were a couple of guys that were pulled down. It was funny because I was standing next to the referee. Now picture this scene, okay? The ref is not on the ice; he's off the ice, okay? Standing, you know, because we've got like a couple hundred people that are now ringing this rink.
And this ref, I'm only imagining is nothing more than a high school hockey player, or is this someone with officiating experience?
I didn't get to grill him, but he was basically a volunteer, an adult volunteer.
Okay.
And the guy gets pulled down, and he turns to the official and like puts up his hands like, "What about that?" And the official looks at him and said very loudly, "I don't want to get involved." As if, I'm not calling anything here because it's up to you guys to win or lose this game. And that's kind of interesting. of course, then there's a woman standing next to him with a drink in her hand, and she's kind of getting into this guy, as in, hey, what do you mean? That was a penalty. You got to call that. And that, that was the guy's answer to her. But you're right. I mean, there is a certain level of honor and sportsmanship here that you don't act like a clown and you don't do anything crazy. And you remember that, you know, people all have jobs to go back to the next day. You know, no one wants to go back there with, you know, with a wrenched knee or a scar across his face or, you know, bloody gash. You know, I mean, you know, show some respect for your opponent and, you know, remember what this is. I mean, this is supposed to be fun. You know, this isn't for the Stanley Cup.
Right. And but when we were kids, you know, we learned to police ourselves. Right. We learned how to officiate our own games.
Yeah.
And you know, we talk about kids today being overscheduled. Kids today are also, I don't want to say over instructed or over officialed, but you know, there is something about figuring things out for yourself that gives you a certain level of responsibility. But also it really does help you mature and grow up and learn how to function like an adult.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there is that is refreshing about the sport of pond hockey as well. And I'm not surprised that when you get further into these tournaments that things get a little bit more competitive. That's just human nature. To get back to an earlier point you made about, you know, the difficulty in crowning a national champion, at this point, it really does seem like a near logistic impossibility. Plus, you mentioned this, the players themselves are happy with how it works now. But in your opinion, what would need to change in order for there to be a national pond hockey champion?
Well, to begin with, USA Hockey, which is the governing body, would have to decide where to have it. That would be difficult because you've got any number of places, either in the Midwest or in the Northeast that could hold it. Then, since you're not giving out any prize money, and these people these teams are coming from all different places out of their own pocket, now it's expensive. Suppose you've got, suppose they decide that they're going to have it in Buffalo, for instance, which is another site where they have a pretty big pond hockey tournament. Though they brought it, though technically it's not on a pond anymore, which is interesting. Now you've got all these people in the Midwest that would have to probably either drive, you know, 12 to 20 hours to get to Buffalo or fly. Very expensive. Especially taking all the equipment. You know, it's, try taking a hockey stick on a plane. You know,
you'll probably be asked to step aside in security.
Yeah, I mean, not to mention the skates.
Sure. I don't think you can check those.
You're going to put all that stuff in check luggage?
No, you're not. But it's interesting because that seems logical to me, which is that the cost, part of the appeal, you know, which adds the accessibility, is that, you know, the sport doesn't necessarily cost a lot, but when you are asking now teams to travel across the country in order to compete in a national championship, you're really asking these people to put up a lot more money.
Yeah.
Money that they don't necessarily have, and when you add money into the equation, it does change the nature of the sport, and it makes it more about competing or winning than it does just actually being outside and playing.
Right. Yeah. And I'm not so sure that, see, to begin with, even if there was a good solution, I'm not sure that it's a problem that needs to be solved.
Interesting.
You know, because the team that won the Lake Nokomis tournament, I talked to the guy that's the captain of the team, and he
yes.
said, I don't want to go any farther than this. You know, I don't want to travel any farther. You know, he's got his own business. You know, he works here. He has no interest in even driving to Wisconsin to play. You know, there's another team that had won this tournament five times. They win it every other year. So this year they didn't win. And he said, we've never gone to the Wisconsin tournament because we feel loyalty to this one here. And there's a lot of that. You know, there's a team, which tournament was it? One of the guys, I can't remember where there was, might have been the one in the UP, where the guy was telling me that they have a team that comes up from Kentucky every year to play in one of their divisions. They did drive up from Kentucky to play.
Do you know how they do?
I'd have to look it up. I don't know.
Not a lot of ponds freezing in Kentucky,
I don't think. Well, I think some of these guys, I think a couple of them were from the Midwest, or maybe
right.
all were from the Midwest. I mean, I didn't talk to anybody on that team. But they're into it. They want to come. And, it's, I don't, and you know, I, it was interesting how my looking at this changed, because I went into this story thinking, you know, maybe they should have a national championship. Maybe we should decide who the real champion is. You know, will the best pond hockey team in the country please raise their sticks, kind of thing. And then the more I talked to people that were involved with this, the more I thought, you know, that's a bad idea. You know, these guys don't want it. They don't really care. And if they don't want it and they don't really care, why should anybody else?
Well, if the reason people may start caring is if a sponsor like Labatt starts throwing around a lot of money and says that here there is going to be a prize, that might change participants' tune as far
as crowning
a national champion.
Talking to the Labatt's people, I don't sense that they want to do that. You know, I think that they like, you know, and I'm not going to claim to speak for you know, the entire company, but my sense from dealing with some of their reps at Lake Tacoma's is that they're very happy doing what they do, where they're the beer supplier, and you know they kick a little bit of money into the tournament, you know they're fine with that. I'm not so sure because they sponsor. I think it's 13 tournaments that they're
involved. Yeah, that's what you said. Yeah. 13. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're probably, Labatt's probably just happy that people keep drinking their beer.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I didn't look to see because there are some of these tournaments up in Canada too, and I didn't look to see. I imagine they're probably involved with some of them, if not all of them too. And I would think that if they wanted to throw big money at a national championship, they would have to cut back their sponsorships of other things. And I don't get the sense that that's what they want to do.
Yeah, and maybe it's best that way.
Yeah.
So last question. I know you've got to go here, and I'm also aware that you cover baseball for the Times and other outlets, and
yes,
you are a New Yorker by birth, and uh-huh. So I'm just wondering, if you were the New York Yankees right now, what would you be doing with Alex Rodriguez?
Probably exactly what they're doing.
Which is?
Well, I think they're in a tough spot.
Because, yes.
you know, I don't think that they can really count on anything from the guy, which I presume is why they went out and got another third baseman.
Yes.
I don't know whether you can even presume that he'll play another game for you. You know, he's been out a year. He's come back from pretty major surgery. It's difficult at any age to come back after that kind of a surgery and after missing a year. I mean, I think that they're really stuck. I think they understand that spring training is going to be a fiasco. The second he shows up, it's going to be a circus.
They asked him, one of the funniest things I've heard is that they asked him not to report a second earlier than any of the other veterans.
Yeah,
they're already trying to limit the circus.
Well, you know, it might be better off having him come early.
Only get it out of the way.
Out of the way. But, you know, again, they're in a position that's extremely easy to criticize, because no matter what they do, there'll be a faction of people who will tell them that they're doing it wrong. This is really kind of uncharted territory, and they'll make some mistakes along the way just because there's no blueprint for this.
Yeah.
I think you just have to bring the guy to camp and see what he's got. In the best of all worlds, from their perspective, you know, maybe he's got a little bit left and they get a little bit of something out of him. The difficulty that they're going to have is if they get 3 weeks into spring training and they realize that he's done.
Right.
And he doesn't realize he's done.
Well, then what you might find is that what I've heard a lot of people talking about in the New York area is that then you might find the doctors getting involved and scanning through the MRIs and the reports and finding something wrong with those degenerative hips, and then maybe the Yankees are able to cash in on some sort of an insurance policy and not be tied to that $60 million or so. And I'll tell you what also makes the issue interesting with Alex Rodriguez is that so far, at least, his teammates on the Yankees, players like CC Sabathia, are coming out publicly and saying, hey, we're excited to have the guy back. And I think that probably puts the front office and Brian Cashman in a slightly interesting position.
Yeah, but, you know, again, what are they supposed to say?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And if you go all the way back to, you know, when he first, you know, several years ago, when they had that big press conference in spring training when he...
Yeah, down in Tampa, right. Yeah,
right,
he came out.
When,
yeah.
You know, you had Pettit and Moe and all those guys in the front row, Posada. all right there showing their support. I mean, that's, you know, and Jeter, you know, that's what teammates are supposed to do, rightly or wrongly. You know, they have to at least put on the public face that they accept them back in the family. One thing the Yankees have always been really, really good at, and this goes all the way back to, you know, 1996 when I first covered them for the Newark Star-Ledger, is they always did a really good job of keeping any kind of grumbling or whatever in-house, dealing with it privately. And Joe Torre was great at this too. And I'm not sure he gets enough credit for this. Just handling all the different stuff within that clubhouse without blowing up into something really, 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 really awful.
Right.
I think that, and let's face it, you know, if Alex does have something left, I mean, this is a team that didn't make the playoffs last year. And this is a team that had trouble, you know, driving in runs last year.
Right.
So, you know, if he's got anything left, you get a bat back and somebody that the other team has to at least think about whether to pitch to him or not. So,
yeah, I there's no guarantee that the first baseman comes back and is healthy. So if he hits, I think the fans will certainly welcome him back if he hits, and the Yankees aren't going to tell him to go away if he's contributing to the team.
Exactly, and you know, keep in mind too that there's something to be said for having a guy in the lineup, even with diminished skills, that the other team has to think about whether or not to pitch to. Remember Mattingly's last year? I mean, he was nowhere near the player that he used to be, but when he came to the plate and late in the game with runners on, the other team had to think about, all right, what do we do here? Do we pitch to this guy? Do we put this guy on? And any time that you make the other team and the other pitcher think, that helps you. Because then if they don't think at all, if they think, all right, I'm just going to go after this guy, they always have the advantage because they know they can get you out.
It sounds like you could be describing the entire Los Angeles Angels lineup right now with guys like Albert Pujols and Josh Hamilton. They're kind of at this point trading on past success, but it's still something a pitcher needs to contend with, that name.
That's right, yeah. And because you never want to be the guy that gives up the hit or the double to the 40-year-old guy that you should have got out. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. I understand. And as Rodriguez gets closer and closer to these milestones, you're not going to be the pitcher that serves up those milestones.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you don't want to be remembered as that guy. You know.
Yeah. Well, Pat Borzi, I know you've got to go, and I wanted to thank you for taking the time to talk with me about the great pond hockey tournaments across the country and a little bit of baseball at the end. And thanks for coming on today, and hopefully we'll get you on again soon.
Well, thanks so much for having me, John. Looking forward to it.
All right. Have a good day.
You too.